Next guy I'm going to introduce is going to introduce our main speaker for tonight. I've known Ralph for quite some time, and he tells it like it is, let's face it. First, this is the month of all months, you know, that Ron, we're approaching the day. I got a Scotch friend here tonight, and he don't like this Irish bit, but anyway, I heard this last year, and I told it last year, so if you heard it, just close your ears. But Patrick was dying, and Mary said to Patrick, she says, "Is there anything I can be doing for you?" He says, "Yes, Mary, there is." He says, "You know that quart of Irish whiskey," he says, "we have in the cupboard?" He says, "Would you be pouring me a snort?" Mary says, "I can't." Patrick says, "Why, Mary?" She says, "I'm saving it for the wake, so I'm going to call on Ralph now."
I don't blame your Scotch friend. There's a lot of Irish guys out here tonight. And my name is Ralph, incidentally. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ralph.
And I think the reason why there's some people don't agree with this, there's a lot of Irish guys like myself out, and my friend on the left here out here tonight, is it seems like every time there's a group of people that get together that have had problems with booze, there's a fair sprinkling of Irish people among them. That's what I've heard. As a matter of fact, I can tell you that I went back, which I've done periodically, to New England, where I was raised, and a couple of years ago, was talking with a friend of mine who's had a lot of trouble with booze, and we got talking about our many friends that grew up like I did and had a lot of trouble with booze, and I think this is often true of alcoholics. It indicated that early in life we drank differently than some of the other people, and I knew of this place, but I'd never heard it. I had never heard it so defined, and there was a swanky inn up in the foothills of the White Mountains in New Hampshire. But over the years since I left, that part of the country has been changed into a high-class dry-out joint, I would call it. And it's a quite expensive place. And this guy had been up there, this friend of mine, three times. And he was, while we were sitting drinking coffee, he was enumerating all of my friends that had been up there. And he says, as a matter of fact, he says, the nickname for the place is the Irish Alps. And I guess it indicated there'd been a few of us up there. So I think there's a touch of bigotry behind that joke. I was unanimously elected for this job tonight, just like I was unanimously elected to serve as the secretary of the Loyola Group for 5 years by a committee of one. That was Josh Higgins. And tonight I was unanimously elected to introduce Barney by Vic. I can't find anybody else that knew anything about it. He said, "You're going to be the something." I don't know what the hell he said, but he said something. And I wasn't asked to comment. I was stuck. And I found out on the way out here tonight with Barney that he called Barney in Santa Cruz and says, "You're going to talk here tonight," and hung up. And the whole group out there has operated that way with a lot of finesse ever since I've been around it. So if I've been irritated a time or two out there, like, let's say, it just reflects the whole life. My home life is that way, too, so. I want to tell you a couple of things about Father Barney that you don't hear every day, because I got to be careful what I say here, because I was about to say I'm the only guy I know of around that he actually 12-stepped. But to come right down to it, I think I am. I know a couple that show up there every so often. There's bound to be a lot of them around, but I haven't met them. But I'm not going to go into any drunkalogue. I don't particularly like them. They don't accomplish much for me, so and that's why I'm up here. But I, before I met him, I had a background of professional treatment, because I thought the only kind of a treatment that would befit a professional person like I was professional treatment. So I had a lot of it, and I had it started one time where I used to drink occasionally with a friend of mine. It was a doctor, a friend of Vic's. We drank together. And he called up my wife, my wife called his doctor up one night, and I'd been drunk just a few days, nothing to get excited about, but she got a little irritated, and she says, "Ralph is drunk again, and he's in pretty bad shape. Do you think I ought to take him out to Raleigh Hills?" And this guy, my friend, says, "What do you want to throw your money," as he put it, "in the street for?" He says, "Take the SB," this is what he said, "down to Salem." That was before Damish State Hospital was open. And I and thinking back, was having the early stages of hallucinations because somewhere along the line I had been reading some ads about that Chateau Frontenac, which is up in Quebec, as I recall, and I've never been in the place, so it isn't anything from memory. And I woke up in the morning down in Salem, and I figured this is a hell of a way to run a high-class operation. This is a fact, and I went to the desk and said, I'm checking out. And I don't know if any of you people remember how they operated down there, but it was the foyer there was not very similar to the Frontenac. And so I went to the door, and it was locked. And I went to the nurse and reminded her that it was locked, and she didn't seem to particularly care. And that was, I had a little psychological and psychiatric treatment down there. It wasn't very effective. And came back to Portland and had some more and wound up in, at the time, I was kind of proud of the fact that I had been in Portland Sanitarium, as they called it then. And this was typical Alky thinking because it's a Seventh-day Adventist hospital, and the truly devout, at least at that time, Adventists frowned upon drinking, and I thought it was kind of a star after my name to get in that hospital for being drunk. And if that doesn't show you that I had a problem, something ought to. Anyway, it didn't work either. So that's the end of my drunkalogue, and this, I had a lot of bad years, and of course they weren't going very well then. So Kaiser Hospital had just opened, and I got in there, and they wouldn't let me in until I paid in advance. This was to discourage me. They didn't want me in there either. I was not wanted hardly any place. And to make matters worse, there was two men in my life that were bothering my wife, and I was one of them, and the lawyer that she had hired was the other one. And this was the shape I was in Kaiser. But she came over that night and she said, I got a Catholic priest coming out to talk to you. And I figured, well, good, because, you know, we have a lot in common. I was a cradle Catholic, and she told me his name, and I said, this guy is probably an Irish Catholic, and he's bound to be sharp. And I had it all figured out, just like Hollywood, that he's going to come out and put his hand on my head and say, that's all right, my son, it'll be better. And then I would get her off my back and dump this lawyer. I was more concerned about the money with him than I was his background. So anyway, that afternoon, as I recall, he shows up. And I'm laying there in that rack with those sides on it because I can leap, you know, 40 feet in any direction. And I got that 55-gallon drum pumped into my arm up there for the I don't know how many times. And he came in, and this is the shape we met. And unfortunately, he wasn't the way I had it figured. That was a bad day. And I remember, I don't know if he does or not, it was Friday. And it wasn't fish day or anything else. It was just plain Black Friday for me. And he walked in the room, and you know, there's something. I heard about this Alky Kahn, but in all the years that I drank, that was the first time I was really aware of it. Because when he walked in the door, I was, for the first time in my life, I was really sharp. I never said a thing. Because I figured, Jesus, I got to figure out how to get rid of this clown. And he hit me, and he says, what do they got here? And he's checking this jug that they're pumping into me for the ingredients. And I figured, now, here's a guy with class. And he's reading, he says, they give me any B1, any B, and he's about halfway giving me a hell. He says, you ought to be getting this, you ought to be getting that. And I keep trying to interrupt and say, Father, I've mismassed a few times, but other than that, I'm a hell of a guy, though. And it took me about 5 minutes to figure out that he didn't particularly care. He was a lousy listener, see, that's So I did manage to sneak out the fact that I had missed Mass a time or two, which came as a hell of a shock to him, you know. And this story's going to get short because he said, I don't think that's going to count for too much. He says, I'll tell you what you're going to do. He says, when are you going to get out of here? And I said, I'm getting out tomorrow because it was kind of expensive there and I'm getting in shape pretty fast. He says, you get your butt over at Loyola Monday night. And he says, all of that other stuff is going to wait, but you get over there, and you get over there at 8 o'clock sharp. You know, I didn't live very far from there. And I went over there, and it was a bad scene. It's not like a lot of these meetings are around now. You had to be a little choosy, you know, about because somebody might cut you off. I don't think anybody ever walked in there and said they was looking around because somebody'd say, well, take a look and get the hell out. And that's what you were talking about, see? And what I learned from now on, and in my own defense, I mean, if these things irritate anybody, it's his fault. Because I learned from him, and it's been good for me. And, of course, that's all I can be concerned about, because it's no game. I think it's, you have to be kind. But I had so many people kind to me for so long, they did a beautiful job of enabling me to stay drunk on somebody else's money. And if I had, I'll never know, so I'm not going to get psyched over this. But I think it's human nature to wonder, at least it's part of my nature to wonder, what would have happened if somebody along the line had just talked to me and told me what the hell it was all about? Like, why don't you hit that street for one? Because you're not getting back in here. And why don't you bail out of here, because we're not paying you for any more dry outs. We're not making your phony expense checks good. And this was going on for years. And it wasn't until I met him and those guys out there. And then you see, to make matters worse, I walked in, and this is the end. I walked in that meeting, and because so many of you people know this guy. And the first guy that I saw when I walked in was Vic, sitting in the end seat, the way we had that deal. And I'd known him for a long time. And the greeting I got, unlike somebody saying, we're glad to see you, like you get at some of the meetings, he just looked up and announced to the group, he says, I figured you'd make it here sooner or later. You know, you got the sweetheart treatment. And that's about what everybody else got, too. And it's cold and hard, and never a cup of coffee was served, and that's the way the program was served up over there, and you get whatever you're looking for. But I will never forget Barney for that introduction. And I think about it like when you come around, when other guys come around, you see, had it been anybody else that ever walked in, in that hospital that day, I would have not gone over to Loyola until the following Monday, because that was my background. So tonight, he's got some things to tell you, and just don't let him be too hard on you, because it's not really that bad. So I'm going to introduce Father Barney to the rest of you.
Thanks, Vic. You kind of make me out to be a bad man. My homecoming, because I look upon this as a kind of a homecoming. I haven't been here for so long, and I see so many friendly faces out there. Go back over 20 years. My sponsor, who's long gone, was probably the one who set the pattern for me individually. Loyola was not my first group. It was my second group. My first group was the Gleason Street Industrial Group, and that was just 20 years ago. And I understand they're opening up their new place this coming Saturday. I went down there for the simple reason that I would be less apt to be detected by any of my retreatants who happened to have been making retreats under me at Loyola Retreat House. That was the only reason. That was the first reason that was given to me by my sponsor. And the second reason was, he says, I want you to see where you're going to end up if you continue to drink. Well, I walked into that place, and I tell you, it was gut AA. There were guys in there that had holes in their shoes that were illiterate, but I never felt so much at home in my life with any group of people than with that group of people down there. They were my people. I understood them. For the first time in my life, I felt understood. After I left the Gleason Street group, we went out to Loyola. That 20 years ago, for a priest to be an AA was quite a thing. to be an alcoholic was quite a thing for a priest to be an alcoholic. In fact, for anybody to be an alcoholic was quite a thing in those days. You're a moral derelict. You didn't have a progressive disease. You're a moral derelict. You're like a leper. Boy, you... Coming in today, these guys say it's so tough to come in. I said, you should have seen it 20 years ago. Was it anonymous? It was underground. I was an anonymous alcoholic. And I did it for self-protection. I didn't want to get sent to the boondocks, which I thought I was going to until I ran into the good archbishop, and he gave me his blessing and told me to go on my way. And that's 20 years ago, and he predicted at that time I'd have a great apostolate amongst the alcoholics. And the man's still alive, 94 years old, 95. And I'm still alive. I don't know why, but I'm still alive, and I'm doing just exactly what he predicted I'd do. I'm out giving retreats all over the country to alcoholics. This is my apostolate. This is my work. This is my thing. Speaking of that industrial group, they had a card out. I don't know whether they still have it, but they had the card in which this prayer, which I've given out, the Serenity Prayer, the complete Serenity Prayer, was printed on the back. And I thought it might be appropriate to kind of tonight to go over it. You know that 11th step? This is a thing that I concentrate on most because that actually is what a retreat's all about. It's a time, it says there, in the 12 by 12, which I recommend that you read, which came out the same year I came in to this program, and which if you didn't have a copy in those days and a copy of the big book, you weren't even a licensed member of this fellowship. You had to have both, and you should have read both of them. But I've run into guys today, been on this program 12, 15 years, and never heard of the 12 by 12. And after I talk to them for a few minutes, I find out why I get some of their interpretations, the various interpretations of the 12 step. They're coming off the top of their heads, and their heads are on crooked. You know, they used to say about the guy that used to try to always rewrite the big book, well, these guys don't even try to write. They just talk from off the top of their head. So the 12 by 12 is the official interpretation of the 12 steps. The 12 steps is the program of AA. You can be in AA, but not necessarily on the program. You're on the program if you're working the 12 steps. Now, how are you going to work something you don't know, that you don't understand? Well, if you read the 12 by 12, you'll find out what it means. And that's exactly what I do during retreats. And as I say, I concentrate on the 11th step, which where we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. One of the finest commentaries I've ever read on prayer is in the 12 by 12 on the 11th step. I don't think I've ever read a better book on prayer than you can find in there. It mentions in there that in prayer, first of all, prayer is the lifting of the heart and the mind to God. And it describes the need for prayer. It says that just as the flowers and the animals and animal life need the sunlight, need the air, the oxygen and the rest of it for human life, in the spiritual life you need prayer just as much for the spiritual growth. And it says this is a spiritual program. That's why we must pray. I have found out that the ones that pray are the ones who need to pray. The needers. They talked about Josh here, Big Josh. I remember Josh used to have a saying, the guys that say, I got to hang up on prayer. I can't pray. Josh used to say, just keep drinking and you'll pray. I don't recommend that. But that's what Josh said. He said, you just keep praying, you keep drinking, and you'll pray. It says there in the 12 by 12, you know, there's various guys that got hang-ups on prayer. Well, an Elkie's got a hang-up on everything. Prayer is the only thing he's got a hang-up. He's got physical hang-up, mental, emotional, moral, you name it. He's hung up for good. And unfortunately, half the time, he doesn't even know it. Everybody else does but him. I had a guy come up one time, and I was giving a talk in 11th step, and he says, I hardly disagree with many things you said. And I said, that's your privilege. Well, he wanted to fight. Says there in the traditions, you're not supposed to fight. Particularly if the guy's bigger than you are.
And then he stuck his chin out right in front of me. He says, I'm an atheist. And I says, well, I happen to be a Catholic priest. Says, what's the quarrel? I said, I wasn't talking theology tonight. I was talking sobriety. I said, what do you want to be, a drunken atheist or a sober atheist? Before I got through, I'd heard his general confession.
Those are some of the worst.
Well, anyway, it mentions in there the various types of prayer, and it talks about mental prayer. Meditare means to think about. Now, some elkies say, you mean that I have to meditate? I said, geez, you're a genius at meditating. And there's nobody I know that's a better meditator than an elkie. I said, what were you doing? You're drinking. You were meditating, thinking about booze, where you were going to get it, where you hit it, what you're going to tell your wife, your boss. I said, geez, you were meditating all the time. That was your obsession. But it wasn't on the spiritual, it was on the spirits. Now we make a little switch. We take the jug away from you, and we give you a book of prayer. Now, it's mentioned there in the 12x12 that one of the forms of prayer is take a prayer like St. Francis, prayer of St. Francis, which I happen to be using now as my retreat back framework for my retreat. The Lord's Prayer. The Serenity Prayer. And take each word and prayerfully meditate on the meaning of it and apply it to yourself. Make it practical. How does this fit me? You see, that's prayer. You talk it over with God about yourself. That's prayer. It's conversation with God. Talking it over with God. And you understand him in your own words. Now, we got a beautiful prayer here, this Serenity Prayer. I don't know how many times a day I say this. This serenity to me is the greatest. I never worry about my sobriety. I worry about my serenity. Because if I got good serenity, I will not lose my sobriety. To me, serenity is the test of the quality of your sobriety. Now, it says God. God as I understand him. For me, he's an infinitely perfect person. He's more than a power. He's more than a hydrogen bomb. I can't get very chummy with a hydrogen bomb. And yet, there are Alkies that look upon God with as much fear as they do a hydrogen bomb. I had a guy come one time and say, he said, gee, Father, I can't pray. I'm too scared of God. And I said, tell me something about your God. Describe him to me. So he started in. He got about 2 minutes into it, and I said, stop. Let's get out of here. I'm scared too. God, I said, if that's God, you're a brave man. He didn't use his word. The name. But that was God as he misunderstood him, see? There were a lot of us were in that position. I didn't feel like praying when I came in. I was so mixed up. I used to pray to pray. I didn't want to pray. I was so fouled up, so discouraged. I'd help so many other alcoholics by sending them to AA to get rid of them. I sent more guys to AA before I ever got on AA than all the AAs in town. But I did it to get rid of them. They used to annoy me, these damn Alkies. Particularly if they were obnoxious or sloppy. I couldn't stand a guy that couldn't hold his booze. They brought a disgrace upon the brotherhood. If you couldn't hold it, don't drink it. And I still to this day have an awful time tolerating a sloppy drunk. I gotta say, oh God, help me, pray for me, help me, help me, help me, help me, keep my mouth shut. You see? Well, anyway, we turn to God as we understand him, power greater than ourselves. It says there, we tried every other thing under God. This is our problem. We always make God our last resort. If everything else fails, then we'll try God.
Maybe he can do something about it.
We try God.
One, it should be just the opposite. He should be our first resort. He should be the first one we turn to. God grant me, petition, ask, and you shall receive. You know, we're needers. We've got to ask. We've got to ask on a daily basis. It says there that our sobriety is contingent on daily contingent on our spiritual condition. We get a daily reprieve contingent upon our spiritual condition. As long as my spiritual condition is okay, my sobriety is okay. It says so in the big book. Grant me the serenity. I don't like the word serenity. It sounds too much like tranquility. And if there's anything that will kill an alkie faster, it's tranquility. Because that's the stuff you were drinking for all those years. The greatest of the tranquilizers. Oh, it had a fooler in it. Cunning, baffling, powerful. The initial effect was to stimulate you. But then it started to work. And you thought it was wearing off. You see, this is how sharp we are. I used to teach organic chemistry. I taught the stuff. Pre-med. I've got doctors that I taught pre-med to. Organic chemistry. And yet I didn't know that. I knew all the formulas. But I used to think it was wearing off, so I'd take another one. So you go up another half floor. Then pretty soon it starts working again. You think it's wearing off, so you take another one. Pretty soon it's worked. And you're out of work. You're asleep. You're passed out. You see, this stuff is tranquilized. You're right out of your shoes. And here we do it, trying it every time. Never learning. This time's going to be different. Serenity, unlike tranquility. See, there's conflict in life. First of all, the first thing we got to remember is that this life is a warfare. I don't care how you look at it. We are not living in a utopia. You see, when we were drinking, we try to get rid of these conflicts with booze. Because booze pulled the curtain on them. It didn't settle anything. It's like they're doing now meat to meat. They don't stop the war, but they have a meeting, and during the meeting, they stop the war for the time of the meeting. As soon as the meeting's over, they start shooting again. They're pretty much the same way. Things are going haywire, so what do? We drink to forget. When we came off of it, they were 3 days older, and the thing was 3 days worse. We didn't solve anything. We went from problems to trouble. Problems to trouble. You see, any time I try to solve a problem with booze, I'll always end up with trouble. I remember an old saying they used to tell me when I first came in, there's nothing that a drink won't make worse. So don't take the first one. You see, it isn't the 55th drink that gets you. It's the first one. With that is the thing that we only keep in our heads, is the first one that does the work. It's like a guy going up a glacier, and he slips. He was over the precipice, he falls 10,000 feet. Well, that's just incidental, that he falls 10,000 feet. He may be smashed up a little more than if he'd fallen only 10 feet. But the mistake he made is when he slipped. When his foot slipped the first time, he was through. He was gone. They say, does an alcoholic have any free will? Yeah, you dang right he has, if he wants to use it. If he wants to use it and not take that first drink, but after he gets a few belts in him, he's got no will. He's got nothing. He's got no brains either. He's had it. Serenity presupposes conflict. It thrives on conflict. That's why I always like to see an alky that's making this program always being pushed around a little, in a little trouble. Not trouble, but problems. I like to see him being pushed.
I hate when a guy comes out and says, oh, geez, everything's going wonderful, Father. God, I got a guy, I say a prayer for him. Oh, God. That's just when a guy is in trouble. See, he's letting his guard down. Everything's going good. He's going good. And then bingo, the next thing you hear, the guy's drunk. Going so good. You know, we can drink either when we're down or when we're up. I remember one guy used to get drunk every time he got a car and was feeling good. He got a car and he got drunk. And so I asked him, I said, why is it when your things are so bad, you're fine, but as soon as things go good, you get drunk? And he said, I want them to be better. I said, you're an alky. If they're bad, you're going to drink. If they're good, you're going to drink. If they're just the same, you get bored and drink anyway. So we can get a reason to drink, excuse to drink at any drop of the hat. You know, the first Serenity Prayer was written in the 16th century in the Old English. I had a copy of it that I gave out to somebody who was going to give it back. You know how that is. But it was called the Soldier's Prayer. It was a prayer that the soldiers said when they went to battle to keep their cool. I call serenity poise in the midst of conflict. Or as a sports fan, I like to make parallels between sports. I like to think of that pitcher that's out there on the mound, the last game of the World Series. There's two outs, bases loaded, last of the night, his team's ahead by one run. And here's our best batter up. And he's got to get that ball past that, on the plate, past that batter. And they all come rushing into him. The manager comes out and says, you can do it, you can throw it. Third baseman comes, second baseman. The catcher comes out and says, put it in here. The guy says, here, well, you take it. I'll trade it. You catch this time. It was so easy, you pitch it. So easy, why don't you guys do it? Now, the real pro, he keeps his cool in the midst of the most terrible pressure, tension that you can possibly imagine. And he gets that ball down over that plate and up past that batter, and he wins the World Series. He stays sober. You see, that's what it takes to make this program. It's a non-professional organization that makes pros. There's no room for amateurs in this AA program. The amateurs don't survive. Because there is no margin for error. Booze doesn't say this poor guy's stupid, so I'll take it easy on him. He made an honest mistake. He'll knock your head off just as much as if you take it maliciously. And it, Booze doesn't care. Booze is patient, cunning. Boy, he'll wait for you to make the... See, Booze is like a good professional team that force you into mistakes. And as soon as you drop that sobriety, bingo, they get the ball.
You'll lose recovery of your sobriety. Who's got it? John Barleycorn recovers. And there goes another ball game. They lose the all-pro game.
You see? So we have to learn how to be able to handle ourselves in all contingencies. I remember talking about the Loyola group. I still think that the original Industrial Group, Gleason Group, and the Loyola Group, I won't say they're the two best groups I've ever been connected with or in throughout my going all over the United States, but I have never seen two groups that are any better. I'll put it that way. That's what I think of. And I think the reason is just what Ralph says. They tell it the way it is, and that there's only one way you could tell it. Truth is one. And you've got to be told. An alky's got, they say, don't tell an alky. Baloney. If you don't tell him, he'll die. I thank God they told me what to do for the first year. I remember my sponsor told me, he says, if you don't know what to do, don't do anything and call me. That was his vote of confidence in me.
And that's why I made it. When I didn't know what to do, I was on the phone and I was calling him, and he was telling me what to do. And I made it. And that was the only way I could have made it. And boy, when he told me to do something, I did it. I put my confidence completely in him, God in him, and I made it. It's the only way I would have made it. Because up to that time, I was doing all the talking. I was giving all the advice. I was a great counselor. That used to use these clarets, these green clarets. That was the only mistake I made. No one ever knew I drank, because I used to keep them away from me. I had a big chair. They couldn't smell me. I had to I practiced ecology way back then. I knew what the smell of, what do they call that, the smell incident, yeah. I knew how far they could be, I could get to them, and I had it all figured out. God, I did more work than the CIA. I never moved from one chair to another. If I was being observed, if I figured I was going to be staggering, I would always wait till I turned. I was always at, and if I thought my speech was a little slurred, I'd be a great listener. The only mistake I made, I used those lousy green clarets. And my tongue was constantly green. Somebody's talking about St. Patrick's Day. I look like St. Patrick all the time. Now, what is the basis of this being able to accept? This serenity. It's acceptance. I gotta accept things as they are. Give me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Now, there's some things I can't change now, but maybe I can change in time. There are some things I can never change, and one of them is my alcoholism. That I can never change. There is no cure. There is only recovery. And that on a day-by-day basis. So I must accept that. There's two ways I can accept a thing, either through compliance or surrender. Compliance is I do it not because I want to, but because I have to. I didn't go into AA because I wanted to. I went in because I knew if I didn't, I would lose my mind because I was already having in the audio DTs, hearing music. And I hated music. And hearing voices of people, and there were no people in the room. That's a frightening thing. That's when I began to negotiate. I figured I want to keep my marbles. Do you see? In other words, that's going to be the same thing. If I were ever to resume drinking, God forbid, I wouldn't fear death. I've come near death 3 times with my heart. I'd fear insanity. That's what I fear more than anything. And I know one thing, I can just see it still. It's kind of like a film, a thin film on my brain that if I ever drank again, it would dissolve and that would be the end of me. I know that just as sure, and I feel it just as sure as the last drink I ever took. And I pray God I never lose that fear. That keeps me honest. Acceptance. I can either do it because I have to or because I want to. Now, I think most of us come in the first way. We come in because we have to. After we hang around a while, we find out this is the life. This is not only just staying off of the bottle, but this is a whole new way of life, a new ball game. And we like it. We like it. It's not so much that we fear the loss of our sobriety as we fear this life, the loss of this life. That we have, this beautiful life, this fellowship that we have. God, I look back over the years since I've been in this program. Do you know there are, I can count on my hand, with one hand, the number of non-alcoholics that I associate with. Not because I've cut them off. I don't have time anymore. The alkies take up all my time. And I really enjoy it. I'm more at home with the alkies. I get one of these non-alcoholics, and he tries to have me explain what alcoholism is. You ever try that?
Boy, that's when I say the serenity prayer. The courage to change the things I can.
Courage.
My sponsor told me that it took two things to make this program. The grace of God and guts. If you got those two, you'll make it. If you don't have those two, you don't make it. Without breaking any secrets, I know of one particular fellow that's a very good dear friend of mine that got on this program by challenging his guts. He was so mad at me, he came on and made it to show me that he could, to disprove the fact that I figured he couldn't make it, and he's still here. Challenging your guts. And I've told many an alky, that's what it hinges on, two things, grace and guts. If you got the grace and guts, you'll make it. If you don't, try it next year. You get your release, try it out, try it again next year. You're not going to make it. Booze isn't the only thing you have to give up when you get on this program either, boy. There are a lot of other things you got to go. You know, there are a lot of various kinds of bottles. And some of them aren't good for any hokey. We have to give those bottles up, too. We got to find out what those are. That's why we have the inventory steps, step 6 and 7. We got to go in there and find out. You know, they say drinking isn't the cause. It's the effect of something deeper. And boy, the longer you're on this program, the deeper you get and the more you see of the things that can trigger your drinking if you ever let them get out of control. Talks about in that big book about those 7 cardinal character defects. Pride, avarice, lust, anger, gluttony, sloth. And it says, boy, they're in there. You can control them, but you can't eradicate them. And just when you think you've got humility down pat, that's when you have reached your highest point of pride. I go around bragging how humble I am. Got that lick. I sure got that pride lick. What is courage? Well, there's various kinds of courage. You know, there's physical courage. Some guys don't have physical courage. In other words, they can't take physical punishment. Some people have a high tolerance of pain. I think most alkies do. God, we go through, Lord, we suffer. Physically. It's unbelievable that we'd ever go back and try it again. I had a wife ask me one time, she said, how can that man... She didn't call him her husband, either. How can that man go back after he's gone through so many terrible things? I said, that's simple. He's able to take the first drink. He gets that down the old hatch, and he's got a maid. This time it'll be different, boy. I'll control everything. I got everything under control this time. I know the secret of it now. Change the brand. How many times did you change the brand? I got tired of that, so I took the cheapest. After the first drink, it made any difference what you're drinking. I never liked the taste of it anyway, so I have to take the cheaper stuff. It goes longer that way. It lasts longer. Courage is a moral virtue not to back down in the face of doing good. That's one definition. Not to quit in the face of adversity. But there's another kind of courage whereby you have the courage to quit something. Quit something that's bad. And that's the kind of courage we need. You see, when we get challenged and they say we're an alcoholic, we can't drink, we go on this other thing, we'll prove it. Disprove it. It's only when we come to the day and we say they were right
and I was wrong. I quit. I throw in the towel. John Barleycorn, you're the champ. You can wear that crown for the rest of your life. I don't want to ever challenge you again. I'm through this business. I've been knocked out for the last time. I want to keep what marbles I got left. That's courage. That takes courage. Particularly when everybody around goes, didn't I tell you? Didn't I tell you? That was my hardest thing, was to have to admit to myself and everybody else who knew me that they were right and I was wrong. But I had to do it to save my life. The courage to change the things I can. I think this is the biggest thing we get out of this program is change. This idea of physical compulsion after you're on this program any length of time, I don't... that part doesn't bother me, or the obsession. Guess maybe because I work with so many guys, and I see so many guys going down the tube, that God, it just scares me to death. When I see booze to me is poison. I'm like the guy who could never quit drinking until he could see in every bottle of booze the word poison. From that day on, he never took another drink. He said, I may be a jackass, but I'm not jackass enough to drink poison. He never took another drink, and he went to AA. That's where I look on booze. I don't care whether it's beer or bourbon. Or rot gut wine. If it's got ethyl alcohol in it, look out. It'll get you. It'll kill you. You know, I don't know why it is. So many of my dear friends and they are dying of cancer. God, I've lost a lot of my friends of cancer. And when you mention cancer, everybody shivers. Terminal cancer. God. You tell a guy, you know, he's got cancer. He'll go to Mayo's. He'll go anywhere. Do anything. Go to any lakes. And beyond that. But, you know, I've seen guys get over cancer. So-called terminal cancer. But I have never yet seen an alcoholic who continued to drink, whoever survived, whoever lived. To me, it's the most terminal of all the diseases. And it's the most comprehensive. It doesn't just affect your mind. It affects every single part of you. The body, spirit, everything is affected. And to think that there are so few of us that are actually trying to do something about our problem. That the hills are just filled with suffering alcoholics who are drinking themselves to death. This is the frustrating thing about it, is when you see so few amongst so many. God, in California, where I do most of my work, well, I heard the other day that there are more alcoholics in the city of San Francisco than all the dope heads in the United States. That's just one city. My God, you meet them at every corner. They're all over. Of course, all you hear about is dope today, you know, the funding. They want to get this money for dope. You talk to kids. I talked to a bunch of them not long ago, a bunch of addicts, recovered addicts. They'll still tell you it's beer and wine. And you know that a lot of these addicts are dying of alcoholism? The majority of them, 98% of them. They can't support their dope habits, so what do they turn to? Wine. They came from withdrawal. And they turn into alcoholics and they die of cirrhosis of the liver. Only 2% of those that die of cirrhosis of the liver die of hepatitis because of a bad needle. The rest of them die as alcoholics. So, we got quite a gathering. We got a lot more than we ever banked on. Besides, just straight alkies, we got all the addicts. See, when I heard that, I said, boy, we're really behind the eight ball. Change the things I can. I can change myself. With God's grace, slowly,
But it'll come back. You have to watch.
One of my problems is anger. God, I got a terrific temper. I mean, not short. But you ask my brothers and sisters how close to death they came on several occasions when I was after them, when I was mad, when I was a kid. I'd have killed them if I got hold of them. I know it. They'd be a little faster than I was, bigger. But with the grace of God and, you know, in athletics, you get to do that in athletics, some guy knock your can off, you kind of learn to control your temper. And I still have that temper, but I got a new way to use it. Transference, they call it. I use it in my talks. I get rid of it on you people. All these frustrations and everything that build up within me, that's why I talk the way I do. I'm not talking against you. I'm talking against the thing that's going to kill you if you don't stop drinking it. That's the guy I hound. I follow all over this country, John Barleycorn. You see, he beat me in booze, and I'm trying to beat him in sobriety. And I'm every place I get a chance to face him, to expose him, I do. The wisdom to know the difference. Wisdom. I think wisdom is a product of two things, prayer and experience. I've met some of the most wise people, wisdom-filled people than any place I've met, than I've been. I've known people in AA that could neither read nor write. But boy, did I ever respect their wisdom. I heard a fellow one night down at Gleason get up and give a talk, and he prefaced his talk by saying that when he came into AA, he had to look up the definition of God in the dictionary. And then he proceeded to give one of the most beautiful spiritual talks I ever heard. It was right from the heart. And I thought, boy, this must be some program when you can start that far down the ladder and come up with something like that. And that's why I hope we never get a generation gap in AA. Gotta hope that never comes. The young need the old need the young. We need one another. And sometimes that we see this happen. Sometimes the old timer, he figures maybe that he's not appreciated or he's pushed back or he's not. We need the wisdom of the man. Whenever I get an old timer, I like to pick his brains. I learn more from those people than I do out of a book. Because they've been there. They've seen it. They've experienced it. And yet I like to get the thoughts of a new man. Because it's been so long since I was a new man that I can forget what it was like. And I've got to keep aware at all times of all types of people. The beginner, the middle, and the end. So I've got to be able to deal and to communicate with all, with every type. They need me, I need them. Living one day at a time, this good AA. Living in the present with the past and with the future. Keep the past, like they say, when you're driving the car, you watch that mirror up there. You're looking back. Occasionally see what's back there to protect yourself. But you're looking through the mirror. You're looking up what's ahead. And you're driving right now. You're not driving 2-3 blocks ahead. You're driving now because you'll have to miss 2 red lights if you start driving too far in advance. So you drive right now, this present moment. Enjoying one moment at a time, one heartbeat. Sobriety should be joyful. It should be a joyful sobriety. That doesn't mean you have to go around laughing or clowning around, but it should be inside. You should be happy with. You should be happy. I hate to see an unhappy alcoholic, because to me, that is what I call the dry drunk.
And brother, if you get on a dry drunk, it doesn't take very long before you wet it down.
And the number one thing that I know of that will get you on a dry drunk is resentments. The number one enemy of the alky is resentments of persons, places, or things.
God, we can resent anything.
That's our problem. The only way I know of handling a personal resentment is when that face comes into my imagination or memory.
I say a prayer for him.
Some guy said the other day, "You mean to say a prayer for that SOB?" I say, "Yeah, say a prayer for that SOB. And you pray long enough, and someday you won't be calling on an SOB. You may see something good in him. In the meantime, you're going to save yourself a resentment. You'll save yourself, and maybe you'll help him. Because if I keep resenting long enough, I'll start feeling sorry for me. Poor me. And as they say, if you cry in your beer long enough, you'll drink it. Self-pity is the most destructive thing on this earth. It always ends up in some form of suicide. Physical, mental, emotional, moral. Suicide. It will eventually destroy you. Take it as you did this sinful world as is, not as I would have it. We are not saints. Amen. God, if any guy ever comes in and says, "I am a saint," I say either that guy's drunk or he's got his head for one. I've always said a saint is a sinner who keeps trying. It'll be that. Sinner keeps trying. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't be trying in that direction, too. Knowing and doing God's will is being a saint. It's not having visions. Hell, I had a guy come up to me one day and want to know about it. He thought I had a spiritual experience. And I said, "I think you've had delayed DTs." Because this guy wasn't particularly careful about what God's will was for him or what he's doing about it. But anyway, he thought he had an experience. He did. When I tolerate something, there's always the element of evil in it. I don't tolerate the good. I approve the good. Physical evil. Sickness. I don't approve that, but I have to tolerate it if I'm going to be any kind of a nurse. If I'm going to go out on a 12-step call on a messy mess, some people can't, their stomach can't take that kind of 12-step call. They like the clean type. Well, if you can't tolerate that stuff, how are you going to help the poor drunk? You don't approve of it, but you tolerate it. Ignorance. You tell a guy, and he keeps having to repeat. Tolerance. Patience. Maybe you were that way. You had to keep being told. You had to learn, fall down in your face, learn the hard way. So you have to be tolerant with this man's ignorance so that you can get some sobriety into his head, some knowledge. So this is what we have to do. We have to be compassionate, like I mentioned the other night. Be compassionate, but never permissive. That's a tough thing to be. Because an alky, I'm talking about an active alky, is a genius at getting hold of a compassionate person like he thought I was, see? Perfect example. I was compassionate, he thought, and he was going to, you know, get me to become permissive. I was. I gave him permission to go to the Loyola group. Not a permission, I gave him a command. You see, but I was compassionate. I did feel sorry for you with all those needles and you sitting in that nice, beautiful outdoor room. God, I thought, what a thing. I didn't tell you half of what I was going to tell you. Trusting that he will make all things right if I surrender to his will. Trusting.
Gee, there's so much trust we have to have in this thing. They say faith is about things unknown. I have to take it on the authority of another. Now, there's a lot of things I don't see or don't understand, but if I take it on the authority of another person, my sponsor, for instance, if he tells me it'll be all right. I look back at my sponsor. There were so many things that used to bug me, and I'd ask him about it. He said, you just wait until it comes. The time comes, and the grace will be there. You see, alkies are guys that we're like when we go out on a trip, we want to have all our, you know, all our tickets and all our reservations and everything all tucked in here and everything accounted for, you know. And Jesus, there's one little loophole of 10 minutes where we might be stuck between... We're all upset. God, we've got to have everything set for the rest of our lives. God. No wonder the guy has to bring a jug with him. Trusting that he'll make all things right if we surrender to his will. We say, dear God, I'm stupid. I have proven it. You're infinitely wise. Just take care of me. Keep me from making too many mistakes today. That's my prayer. Keep me from making too many stupid mistakes. And he does, usually. He pulls me out of some of the dangest things I get into. I see afterwards, my God, it had to be God, or this thing would have gone up in smoke. That I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever in the next. This is what we have an awful hard time settling for, is reasonable happiness. I've never found it yet.
Reasonable happiness.
God, it's got to be real happy. It has to be the best, the greatest. That's us.
Maybe you Al-Anons won't agree with this, but someone has said that the Alky's a little more attuned to the supernatural, the eternal.
They also say we have a higher IQ. I don't know of anybody that has ever said that except an Alky, but anyway. So I won't contest the thing. Now I'm going to end up on one little note. I hope that I've helped you with this little prayer and that you use it, take it, and use it. I don't remember all of it. I know the first part. I say it 1,000 times a day. When I want to keep my cool and I'm ready to lose it, I say, God grant me the serenity. I start praying. And by the time I get through halfway through it, I forget what I was getting mad about. If for nothing else, it's a tremendous distraction. Prayerful distraction.
I guess.
All I know is this. In my experience with my own self and work with other alcoholics, that we have one of two choices. Either the spiritual or the spirits. We've got to get spiritual some way or how. And there's only one way we can do that, and that's through the help of God. We can't do it on our own. Any more than we can handle the spirits on our own. It took God to get us off of the spirits. It takes God to get us on the spiritual. But he will, if asked. And so I want to thank you for asking me to come here to talk and to renew old acquaintances. Jesus, it looks beautiful to see some of you folks I haven't seen for years. And some of you say, my, you're looking better each year. I must have looked like heck about 5 or 6 years ago. Because every year I'm looking better. So I don't know, I still must be looking bad, but I'm looking better than I was a year ago. I guess that's what they mean. Is that right, Frank? Well, God bless you.